From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, we'll hear from Professor Howard Zinn. But first, more on the tragedy in Moscow. We'll speak with a former Soviet bioweapons scientist and a U.S. scientist who says the U.S. is encouraging a breakdown in arms control by its research into biological cluster bombs, anthrax, and non-lethal weapons. Why did 117 hostages die from unnamed gas used by Russian special forces to free them? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Russia is prepared to strike at international terrorist groups in whatever country that harbor them. His comments come days after Russian special forces stormed a Moscow theater where Chechen rebels took 750 hostages. The siege ended when Russian troops piped in an undisclosed gas that killed 115 civilians. Russian troops shot most of the Chechens dead. The U.S. Embassy in Moscow says the gas used was not a nerve gas as previously suspected, but an opiate which dulls the senses. Putin gave no hint of where he believes international support for Chechen rebels may be located, but Russia has in the past accused Islamic extremists of assisting the Chechen cause. Putin's talk echoed that of President Bush, who's praised the Russian war in Chechnya. Last month, Putin threatened to launch preemptive strikes against Chechen fighters operating in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. British and American academics are warning the U.S. is developing a new generation of biological and chemical weapons that possibly violate international treaties. The Guardian of London reports today the Pentagon and British military are working on non-lethal weapons similar to the gas used by Russian forces to end last week's siege in Moscow. The CIA is trying to copy a Soviet cluster bomb designed to disperse biological weapons. The Pentagon is attempting to build a bioweapon plant from commercially available materials. The U.S. claims the experiments are done for defensive purposes. We'll be speaking with a University of California scientist about these issues in a minute. In related news, a U.S. diplomat, Lawrence Foley, was shot dead yesterday in Amman, Jordan. He was gunned down outside his house in what appeared to be the latest in a string of attacks against Western targets in the region. Journalist Robert Fisk writes in The Independent, quote, "Amman is burning with anger at the United States and its threats against Iraq. More than half of Jordan's population is Palestinian, and America's unconditional support for Ariel Sharon's Israeli government has embittered many of them. Demonstrators have often called for the end of Jordan's 1994 peace treaty with Israel." The CIA has warned that U.S. counter-terrorist operations around the world may not eliminate the threat of future attacks because they failed to address the root causes of terrorism. The CIA added that continued instability in Afghanistan and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict were likely to fuel radicalism in the Muslim world. The assessment was made in a series of written answers to questions posed by members of Congress that were released to the general public yesterday. The New York Times is reporting that the United States has quietly begun working with Iran to shut off the flow of illegal Iraqi oil in the Persian Gulf. The U.S. and allies have stationed an Australian warship inside Iraq's territorial waters and have doubled the number of searches this year of ships in the Gulf. Iran, which President Bush has described as part of the Axis of Evil, has provided coastal units of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as well as naval vessels. A team of about 50 Israeli commandos have entered western Iraq to hunt for Scud missiles. This according to a report in the London Times. Israel claims the mission is needed to foil any preemptive attack by Iraq on Israel. The Times reports the Scud hunting is not the Israeli Special Forces' first mission inside Iraq. The same unit has planned at least twice to assassinate Iraqi President Saddam Hussein near the town of Tikrit. And Japanese officials are reporting that North Korea has refused demands to scrap its nuclear weapons program. The U.S. and its allies have urged North Korea to disarm peacefully, but North Korea has been warning it is entitled to possess nuclear weapons and other more powerful weapons to defend itself against U.S. hostility. And you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. If there's one place in Iraq where people know what the Bush administration has to gain by seizing the country's oil wealth, it's the Iraqi oil ministry. In an exclusive interview with Democracy Now!, the general director of Iraq's oil program accused Washington of seeking to send the country into a state of Armageddon to capture the country's oil fields. The comments come in the latest installment of Democracy Now!'s Iraq Journal, produced by correspondent Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Jackie Suin on the ground in Baghdad.
It's an understatement to say that Baghdad is a congested city. Every street is jam-packed with cars, most of them from the 1980s and earlier. But no one here is concerned much about driving a gas guzzler. Fuel is practically free. In fact, it's cheaper than clean water. Much cheaper. A gallon of gas costs less than 5 cents. A liter of drinking water costs about a quarter. As the U.S. begins its major push for war at the United Nations, there is little doubt here that oil is once again fueling the crisis. Iraq holds the second largest oil reserves in the world, with more than 112 billion barrels. Add to that the more than 200 billion in potential reserves, and it's not difficult to understand why the oligarchy in Washington is gearing up for an attack. Worldwide, the demand for oil is on the rise, not just in the world's biggest consumer, the U.S., but also in large nations like Russia, China, and India. And as this demand grows, oil-producing countries are being pushed to increase their capacity. And if there's one place in Iraq where people know what the U.S. has to gain by taking over Iraq's oil industry, it's at the Ministry of Oil. Fala al-Hayat is the general director of Iraq's oil industry.
Where do you get the oil from? Saudi Arabia is approximately producing to capacity. It cannot, it tried to produce more oil, it cannot. The only potential country that could increase its capacity quickly, cheaply, and substantially is Iraq. It is not only it has the second largest reserve in the world, but potentially it has the largest oil reserves in the world. Secondly, it has already very great giant fields ready to be utilized. The amount of investment and the amount of time required to put these fields into production is minimal, 2 to 3 years. And then you immediately double its capacity from its present 3 million barrels per day to 6 million barrels per day, which is equivalent to the total spare capacity going in the world today.
This past June, Iraq marked the 30th anniversary of its nationalization of foreign oil companies by announcing that it was beginning oil exploitation at two sites that it described as gigantic oil fields. The West Ghorna and Majnoon fields lie in southern Iraq and have gone untapped for decades. They were repeatedly attacked during the Iran-Iraq War, as well as the Gulf War. West Ghorna, which is known here as the Giant, had been contracted to the Russian company Lukoil, but Iraq accused the company of bowing to U.S. pressure not to begin drilling. Fala al-Hayat says the fields represent two of the largest untapped reserves in the world.
We're talking about 500,000 barrels each, at least. Now, this together, they'll make 1 million barrels a day. And that is as big as many OPEC countries. Now, we're talking about the giant fields. At the tip of the Gulf, on a flat ground, not in the wilderness of Alaska or in the isolation of the Caspian Sea. You see, when you invest in oil, what is important is what's the reserve, is how much you can get out. Now, all this investment in the Caspian Sea, platforms, drillings, pipelines from Baku to the Mediterranean going through countries and mountains and whatever is to exploit 15 billion barrels of oil. Now, 15 billion barrels of oil is equivalent to the reserves of the West Gorna field second stage, which we have signed with the Russians, and they are a breach of its contracts. I just want to with this example, is to tell you what is the potential and the capability of the Iraqi oil industry. And it is sitting at the tip of the Gulf. Now, that is, if you control the Iraqi oil, right, now you are halfway there to control the world oil. You see? And with your substantial hold on the Saudi fields, then you are in complete control of oil supplies for a long time to come.
Despite Washington's constant threats against Iraq, the Bush administration certainly isn't putting its money where its mouth is. Iraqi oil continues to flow through the U.S. America's a major purchaser of Baghdad's oil. But it doesn't buy it directly from Iraq. Instead, American corporations buy Iraqi oil from French and Chinese middlemen. That's how Iraq's Basra oil ends up in the U.S.
American refiners love the Basra oil. It is optimized on their refinery. They get more yield from the oil than any other type of oil. And also, because of the distance from Basra to the USA, they get benefits out of the differential. So it's a bit cheaper, and it exactly fits the refinery. I love it. By the way, it's a known fact that we always sold our oil, lots of oil, to the United States, irrespective of the political situation. And probably that's why these people from Texas who rules the American administration is that they want to send us to Armageddon just to get their hands on the fields in Iraq.
Al-Khayat says this is why the oligarchy wants to send Iraq to Armageddon, just to get their hands on the oil fields. As the Bush administration begins its major push for a resolution at the UN that could pave the way for a massive attack on the country, the saying born during the administration of Bush the father rings true with his son in the White House. When it comes to Iraq, it's all about the oil. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
You are listening to Democracy Now!. Special thanks also to Jackie Suen and Rick Rowley of Big Noise Tactical Media. If you want more information on Iraq Journal, you can go to democracynow.org or iraqjournal.org. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's ignoring international requests, including many from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, to identify the gas which left 117 hostages dead in a Moscow theater raid this week. Chechen rebels had held 750 hostages in the theater since last Wednesday. Russian troops pumped the gas into the theater's ventilation system before raiding the building. Russian authorities initially claimed the raid was called because rebels had begun executing hostages, but the Moscow Health Community Center reports only one hostage died of gunshot wounds. New York Times is reporting U.S. officials say the Russian security police might have used an aerosol version of a powerful, fast-acting opiate called fentanyl. U.S. medical experts say that fentanyl is dangerous to children under 12. Survivors and relatives of victims said at least 10 of the dead were children. U.S. officials say they're confident the Russian authorities did not use an illegal nerve gas in their mission to rescue 800 hostages from a Moscow theater. Senior U.S. authorities and private experts also say the agent was probably similar to one of an aerosol of non-lethal weapons that the U.S. is quietly studying for use by soldiers and police officers. According to The Guardian, respected scientists on both sides of the Atlantic warned yesterday that the U.S. is developing a new generation of weapons that undermine and possibly violate international treaties on biological and chemical weapons. Meanwhile, Moscow family members of victims are angry. Russian authorities have yet to issue definitive lists of victims and survivors or to allow hospitals visits, even for relatives. Health officials report they were not notified until a very short time before the raid that they should be prepared to treat patients for overdoses of the gas. Ambulances on the scene were unprepared to treat people. The chief Moscow doctor yesterday said medics are struggling to treat their largely unconscious patients without an effective antidote. We're joined right now by Vil Merzianov, a former Soviet chemical weapons specialist. He believes the gas is a modification of BZ gas, a toxic chemical agent that he worked on. In September 1992, he revealed that the Soviet Union had produced the most lethal binary nerve agent known to mankind, known as Novichok, the newcomer. It was up to 10 times more powerful than its nearest U.S. equivalent, known as VX. He was jailed twice for whistleblowing. He joins us on the line now from Princeton. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Merzianov. Can you start off by telling us your reaction to the use of this gas by the Russian special forces?
Yes, I know about all his history, but I believe that despite these explanations, New York Times today, this fentanyl and the other some kind of drugs were used in this time, it's tough to buy this information. It's more probably it's hint. Maybe some kind of prompting to for Russian government to agree with fentanyl version. I don't know what's the goal of these authors, but as far I know, it's not so easy to develop and then synthesize, develop and then produce such a sophisticated agents. I've been participating in these works on development of technology BZ gas under the name of Substance 78 in 1980s. During these experiments, during this development of technology, my colleagues discovered that one of versions of these agent, a little bit altered version, of this drug is very good anesthesia agent, anesthesia drug. It's this drug passed all tests, including tests in military hospital, Moscow hospital. But because this drug was still classified and directly connected with prohibited BZ gas, sure, it's a secret gas still. And secondary, the State Institute of Organic Chemistry and Technology, where I was working 26 years, last position, my position there was chief technical counterintelligence department. So we used this facility to produce this agent. And then after that, sure, our leadership, the former leadership, promoted this drug for anti-terroristic, as anti-terrorist weapon. So,
were you surprised that the Russian forces used the gas that they did?
I was not surprised, unfortunately, because Soviet, they have this government, the same Soviet government, they have the same mentality. When coming some problem, they all the time choosing more easy, simplified way for resolution this problem. Instead, political, for looking for political solutions, they all the time taking the side of use power, force. It's for me, it's not surprising, but shocking, sure. The result is shocking because I'm also guilty. I participated some time in development of this drug.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We're also joined by Anne Nivat, who is Moscow correspondent for the French newspaper Libération, who's covered the Chechen war from inside Chechnya, dressed as a Chechen woman. We'll also talk to Mark Wheelis, who is a senior lecturer at the Department of Microbiology at UC Davis, about U.S. biological weapons that are being developed. Stay with us.
Everyone is crying out for peace. Yes, none is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace. Yes, none is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to talk about what happened in Russia at the Moscow Theater, Chechen rebels laid siege to the theater, but the resultant level of death, more than 117 Russians and others believe dead, are a result of the use of by Russian special forces of a gas which they have yet to identify. We're talking to Dr. Vil Mirzayanov, who is former Soviet chemical weapons specialist, and Anne Nivat, who is Moscow correspondent for the French newspaper Libération. Anne Nivat, we spoke to you when you came to the United States to talk about your coverage of the Chechen war within Chechnya. Can you talk about your response to what's happened in Moscow?
Well, in fact, I'm absolutely not surprised at all by what has happened in Moscow because the most important thing I would like to draw your attention to is that the people who took this theater are not Chechen rebels, because one has to draw a difference between the Chechen rebels, the fighters, the ones who are fighting against the Russian troops in Chechnya in order to obtain the independence from Russia, and some other groups, such as this one, the commando, the group, the of the people who call themselves Mujahideens, who came to Moscow in order to die. Don't forget that was their first goal. They say they expressed the will to die as soon as they arrived in Moscow. They came into Moscow to die first, to die as Shahid, which means because they think that in order to in fighting against the infidels, they're gonna be welcome in paradise, and that's exactly what they wanted to accomplish in Moscow. And those people are Wahhabis, and the Wahhabism, this kind of extremist fundamentalist, is not the majority in Chechnya. So that is very important to underline. And I think that what happened in Moscow is not surprising because of the refusal of the Kremlin after 3 years of the beginning of this conflict to start any kind of negotiations with the rebels. And the rebels are led by a president. His name is Aslan Maskhadov. I don't even remember how many times since the beginning of the conflict, which is October 1999, how many times Maskhadov has wanted to start a negotiating process, a peace process, and so far, on the Kremlin side, there is absolutely no chance that this could happen. And I think that not even a second Mr. Putin, the Russian president, had any intention to start the negotiation process during this hostage taking. It's just the opposite. And the result of what happened is that now it will be even more difficult for the Chechen conflict to be resolved. And that is what makes it even more dangerous to my point of view, because what happened Wednesday evening can happen again. That is absolutely evident. It can happen again in Russia, because those people who are doing it are not afraid to die, and they are not under anyone's control.
What about Putin saying that he would launch preemptive attacks in Chechnya?
Putin has tried to conduct a so-called anti-terrorist operation in Chechnya, because don't forget that what's happening in Chechnya is not even called a war. I've been there covering it. I've been living among Chechens. I spent at least 7 months in a row under heavy bombings. Believe me, it's a full-time war what's going on down there. Well, yet the Kremlin is calling it an anti-terrorist operation. So an anti-terrorist after 3 years, I don't really see any success of this anti-terrorist operation, because first of all, what happened in Moscow is the vivid proof of the fact that the war is not over the way the Kremlin is suggesting it is. Second of all, there is absolutely no normalization process going on in the Chechen Republic, as again the Kremlin is pretending it is. I was there last time in June for 5 weeks, and unfortunately, I can only say that the situation is absolutely not improving. It's just the opposite. It's just worsening every day. There are no infrastructure left. The schools, some of them reopened, but most of them didn't. There is absolutely no future for anyone in Chechnya. No jobs. Nothing. Only fightings on the Chechen side. It's a guerrilla war. And on the Russian side, you have a bunch, I mean, a lot, 80,000 troops there, pretending that they are in control of the republic, whether in fact they are only controlling a few checkpoints, road checkpoints on main roads of Chechnya. And those checkpoints, they are not even controlling them, because I've been the witness of how often anybody, including Chechen rebels, can go through any kind of checkpoint by bribing the soldier who is standing there.
Anne Nivat is Moscow correspondent for the French newspaper Libération. On the line with us also, scientist Vil Mirzianov. And also with us is Mark Wheel, a senior lecturer, Department of Microbiology at University of California, Davis. I wanted to switch gears back to the chemical weapons that were used and the fact that respected scientists on both sides of the Atlantic are warning that the United States is developing a new generation of weapons that undermine and possibly violate international treaties on biological and chemical warfare, and tie this into what was used against the rebels and in the end the captive audience inside the church, inside the theater. Mark Wheelis, can you talk about your understanding of what was used and what the U.S. is developing here?
Yes, I really don't know what was used, and I think it's premature to try to be too definitive about that. The primary speculations have been BZ, supposedly non-lethal agent that has been in military arsenals for quite some time, and some form of inhalable opiate. But the information that's available on the Internet so far is contradictory and inconclusive, and I don't think at this time that we can say with any certainty what was used. What doesn't surprise me about this is the fact that the Russian Special Forces troops were equipped with a putatively non-lethal chemical agent for use in situations like this. They presumably had trained with it. It was part of their operating procedures. This is, although I had not known that they were doing this before, it certainly doesn't surprise me, knowing that the United States has been for well over a decade very actively pursuing so-called non-lethal weapons for exactly this kind of situation. The use of any chemical weapon, lethal or non-lethal, is prohibited in as a method of warfare by the Chemical Weapons Convention. But there is an exemption in the Chemical Weapons Convention that allows chemical agents to be used for law enforcement purposes. This exemption has, I believe, two principal purposes. One is to allow countries to use riot control agents for domestic riot control. And the other is to allow those countries with that still have capital punishment to use chemical agents for enforcing capital punishment. So that law enforcement exemption was necessary to achieve international agreement on the Chemical Weapons Convention. But it was the very clear intent that that no chemical agent, lethal or non-lethal, should be used by militaries as a method of warfare. Now, the U.S. has interpreted the term method of warfare to refer only to international conflict, that is, conflict between nations. And so their legal experts, the Pentagon's legal experts, assert that the use of non-lethal agents is legal in what they call military operations other than war, which would include counterterrorism, hostage rescue, and the like. This is, in my view, a bit disingenuous. Even if we accept that very narrow interpretation of the phrase method of warfare, which I do not think was intended to be interpreted so narrowly, but even if we grant the U.S. the right to interpret that phrase so narrowly, it's still not clear that most military operations other than war would in fact be law enforcement actions, which would be also necessary for it to be legal. In any event, despite the possible illegality of developing non-lethal chemical agents for military use and developing the military munitions like mortar shells to deliver them, the United States has been plunging very actively, full speed ahead in this area. I think, you know, the lessons of Somalia, Lebanon and the like suggest that to military tacticians that we desperately need better ways to handle these very messy modern engagements in which combatants and non-combatants are intermixed. So the United States has been actively engaged in such a program, developing such weapons, both calmatives to calm people down and so-called malodorants, which are agents which smell so offensive that the only real option to people exposed is to retch and run. At least these two kinds of agents are under active development and munitions to deliver them. Given that the U.S. is doing that, and given that the U.S. Activity in this area is pretty well known, it's no surprise to find that other countries in the world are also moving down this path. I think this is a matter of very great concern. I think that the widespread proliferation of non-lethal chemical, so-called non-lethal chemical weapons, and as an aside, I would say that the substantial mortality in Moscow is a vivid reminder to us that there really is no such thing as a non-lethal weapon. There are simply weapons with somewhat less lethality than others. The widespread proliferation of this kind of weapon, I think, would be extremely destabilizing. It would provide a rationale for developing the artillery shells, the missile warheads, the mortar shells, et cetera, to develop chemical agents, which would otherwise be prohibited under the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Professor Willis, the U.S. blocked an attempt to give the convention teeth with inspections so that member countries could check if others were keeping the agreement.
It was actually a different but closely related treaty. There are two treaties, the Biological Weapons Convention signed first in 1972 and the Chemical Weapons Convention signed later in 1993. The Chemical Weapons Convention, as it was negotiated, had an enforcement provisions in it that allows for international inspections of both routine of facilities that possess certain chemical agents, declare certain chemical agents, and of other chemical facilities that perhaps have the potential for producing them, and of suspect sites. There's no such provision in the Biological Weapons Convention, and the United States was actively engaged in about a 10-year process of trying to negotiate such an additional...
We only have 10 seconds.
Okay, but we backed out on it last year, probably to conceal active, probably defensive research, but research that stepped over the line.
Like programs to produce dried and weaponized anthrax spores, officially for testing U.S. biodefenses...
Other things that were revealed by Times reporters last year.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor Mark Wheelis of University of California, Davis, and Navat, Moscow correspondent for French newspaper Liberation, and Vio Mirzianov. And that does it for this segment as we move now to some of the speeches given around the country this weekend against war. The first by Leonard Weinglass, civil rights attorney in Washington, D.C., at the mass mobilization against war of more than 150,000 people.
I'm here to speak to you today about five Cuban men who took up the struggle against terrorism directed at their country from the United States and are now serving life sentences in America's prisons. You might remember that the justification for the war in Afghanistan was that any country that hosts terrorists is as guilty as the terrorists themselves. For 40 years, this country has hosted a network of terrorism in Florida directed at Cuba. It has recruited them, trained them, and armed them. And when Cuba repeatedly asked the United States, the host country, to rein in our terrorists, they were met with inaction. And so the Cubans sent a group of people here to monitor the activities of the terrorist network in Florida. And when they got too close, the FBI stepped in and arrested the five and prosecuted them before the exile community in Miami, and they were sentenced to life terms in prison. Their case is now under appeal and needs your support. This case is more easily understood if you think of the case of Orlando Bosch, a member of that terrorist network who planted a bomb on a Cubana airline in 1978, which exploded in midair, killing 73 people. Mr. Bosch applied for residence in the United States after that episode, and the Justice Department and the INS deemed him an undesirable person, pointed to 30 years of terrorist activity, including the bombing, and asked that he be barred from entry in the United States. But Orlando Bosch had a friend in Florida, a young man who wanted to be governor. His name was Jeb Bush. He intervened with his father, who was then the President of the United States. And George Bush Sr. overruled the Justice Department and the INS and granted Orlando Bush residence in the United States. He now walks as a free man in Miami, Florida. He walks as a free man while the five, who had no guns, no explosives, created no harm in the United States, did not involve themselves in any classified information here, did not interfere with national security, are serving life in maximum security prisons here in the United States. The next time the Bush administration moralizes about the war on terrorism, remember Orlando Bosch and remember the Cuban Five. Thank you.
Leonard Wineglass, civil rights attorney, speaking at the mass mobilization against war in Washington, D.C., where more than 150,000 people gathered this past Saturday. When we come back from our break, we'll go to other protests and speak-ins and rallies that took place in the last few days. We'll go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Boston, Massachusetts. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Jordan River, Iroy, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the protests that took place this past Saturday in Madison, Wisconsin, where more than 1,000 people gathered, Will Williams addressed the crowd, a two-term Vietnam vet and great-grandfather of four.
About 40 years ago, I joined the U.S. Army to escape the hard times and poverty in Hard Times, Mississippi.
Right.
2 years later, Lyndon Johnson signed the resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. A few weeks ago, the Congress sold out and signed Bush's new resolution to go to war with Iraq. I'm speaking not as one that is advised by advisors as Bush is, but one that physically shed blood on the battlefield in Vietnam for a cause at that time that I thought was just. After my first tour, when I came back to the United States, I faced protesters, which I didn't understand and didn't know what was going on. So I put in a 1049 to go back to Vietnam to escape the protest. The last time I came back, I began to research and find out the policies of this country and why people were protesting. And that's why I'm on a battlefield today with you to fight another war. We could not win a war in Vietnam. It was unwinnable. But we can win this war today because this government belongs to the people. And I believe that we will take it back from the people that are controlling it. I've also been called unpatriotic because of my stand for what is right and what I believe. And I dare anyone in Bush's administration or anywhere to challenge that patriotism. Yeah! I did what my country ordered me to do because I was in the military. But it was not right. And years later, Bob McNamara, the Secretary of Defense at the time I was there, even spoke out and said Vietnam was a mistake. And I tell you now, Iraq is a mistake. Yeah. Iraq is not the imminent danger to America. This administration is the imminent danger. Those very rights that I fought and bled for have been denigrated by the Patriots Act that this Congress laid down and let it pass. And we want those rights back. In order to kill in a war, you have to be able to strip the human face from a person. I did that. And since then, I've seen human faces. I've even seen the faces that I stripped, and I live with it every day and every night. War is more than just going and killing somebody for whatever reason. And this reason is oil and oil alone. Power. That's right. This administration tells us how dangerous nuclear weapons are, the threat. Why are we proliferating? Why did George Bush break a treaty with Russia that had been standing for years? I don't believe in nuclear weapons either. I don't feel that anyone should have it. But if this country can have it, then every country should have it, because without it, there is no balance of power. And we end up with imperialism or dictatorship. And that's the course that we're traveling. In ending, I have a song I want to give to George Bush and his followers. And you might remember it from years ago, and the people would say to the people, you got to give the power to the people. You got to give the power to the people.
Vietnam veteran Will Williams speaking to a mass gathering in Madison, Wisconsin. And as we make our way up the East Coast, we go to Boston, Massachusetts, where Howard Zinn addressed a Boston speak out against the war at Boston University. Howard Zinn, radical historian, author of People's History of the United States.
Who are America? Listen to them. We're not putting them down. We're putting down the makers of war. We're putting down the people who are stealing the wealth of this country and using it for military purposes while there's not enough money for medical care. There's not enough money for housing. I mean, you read the papers and you see there's 6,000, 8,000 people in the city of New York who are sleeping on the streets or in shelters. California is going through a medical crisis. There's no money to give people the basic things of life, and there is all of this huge sums of money going for war. I mean, something is fundamentally sick about a society that does things like this. And so those are the things we have to point out. A few general points about war. War is always, you know, people get just war, unjust war. This is a good war, that's a bad war. Let's examine this war, so on. I had a student who wrote a paper about war, and she said, war is not like wine, where you have a good year and a bad year, and, you know, a good war and a bad war. No, she said, war is like cyanide. One drop and you're dead. And war is always the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of people for dubious purposes, really. And in war, the means are always horrible and certain. The end, even when it's presented as a good end, is always uncertain. And therefore, war inherently cannot be justified as a way of dealing with the problems we have in the world. Just one more thing, although you always have to be aware when the speaker says just one more thing, they usually don't mean it. When people speak, will say, and in conclusion, and then go on for another hour, you see. But we'll see if I mean this. Test of my own integrity. To go to war means, whether it's war against Iraq, war against Afghanistan, go to war anywhere, means that you do not consider the lives of other people as important as the lives of the people in your country. It means that you don't consider that the children of Iraq have an equal right to life as our children. Just as when we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we were saying the children of Hiroshima and Nagasaki do not have the same right to life as our children. That's what war means. And it's important to confront that and to confront other people with that, because most people really believe that, yes, human beings are equal. Human beings have an equal right to life. But when you make war, you are saying, no, they do not have the same right to life that we do. If we believed that people had the same right to life, we couldn't make war. If we believed that the people in Africa and Asia and everywhere else had the same right to the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as us, we would be taking these billions and billions of dollars for war, and we'd be using it for medicine and food, and we would no longer be a military superpower, which is a disgusting thing to be, really, and we would become a humanitarian superpower in the world, and do something to change this century from the way things were last century. Thank you.
Join me in welcoming Medea Benjamin.
To Medea Benjamin. This is Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange.
Raise your hand if you're a parent. Woo! Raise your hand if you're a grandparent. Whoa! One right here. Just think of what's happening right now. We have a president that is sending the ships, sending the war machines, sending the bombs, sending the troops. And look what we have growing here at home, a mass, beautiful movement that's going to stop them from dropping those bombs. And we're part of a mass, beautiful global movement on the streets in Italy, on the streets in France, on the streets in Australia, in Egypt, in Tony Blair's England. We are the majority of the world's people, and we are going to stop George Bush. And look what we're building in responses to Bush All for War. We are building a movement for solar, for wind power, for public transportation, for bicycle power. And I want to talk to the women here. Raise your hand if you're an unreasonable woman. We have a new group called Unreasonable Women for Peace. And on November 11th, we are going to launch on Veterans Day in honor of the veterans, saying the best way to honor the veterans is to work for peace. We will launch a hunger strike in front of the White House. Every day, 7 days a week, we will be out there in front of George Bush. We need you with us. We need you, unreasonable women, to join us. We need to stop the testosterone poisoning of our globe. We need to stop the lethal combination of oil and testosterone. We, the women, have to come forward and say, while George Bush is saying to the world that the U.S. military is going to go anywhere it wants and change any regime it wants, we, the women, in a nonviolent, grassroots, beautiful way, will step forward and what do we say? Regime change begins at home. 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 Join us November 11th, hunger strike in front of the White House. power to the peaceful. We love you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Keep the phone call.
Well, folks, we're almost ready for that time. Look, let me just say one thing. A little housekeeping things here. We've got plenty of literature tables out there. Please go out and visit the literature tables that we have out there. Also, we have
Bush War Machine. Brothers and sisters, on behalf of the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in San Francisco, I bring you greetings and solidarity because you are the fighters, the true fighters, for social justice and peace. In keeping with our progressive history, we are one of the first unions to come out against the war because we say no new war against Iraq, no blood for oil, no death to innocent Iraqi people, in particular women and children, no colonial occupation of Iraq, no taking control of their oil fields. If there is a regime change in Iraq, let the Iraqi people make the change and not George Bush. Brothers and sisters, as you all know, the ILWU was under assault by not only the Pacific Maritime Association, but also the Bush administration. You have to understand one thing. The ILWU is the union that refused to unload cargo emanating from South Africa, that set into motion a chain of events that brought down apartheid. We are the union that shut down the port in 1999 in support of the WTO. We are the union that shut down the port in 1999 in support to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Brothers and sisters, the war on terrorism has a component. It's the war on against our rights. A war against our civil liberties, the U.S. Patriot Act, which locks up immigrants who are not terrorists, taking away their rights, Homeland Security, Homeland Police over our free American citizens, Port Maritime Security Act, which treats maritime workers as if they're potential terrorists. The Bush administration has promised to use the military to load and unload cargo in the event of a strike. And we say this to George Bush: hands off the docks, stay out of Iraq. Join me in this chant. Hands off the dock, stay out of Iraq. Hands off the dock, stay out of Iraq. Let me hear you. Let me hear you. Hands off the dock, stay out of Iraq. An injury to one is an injury to all.
Professor Howard Zinn addressing Boston Speak Out Against the War at Boston University. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a video or audio of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Caron, Anna Noguera, and Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. Special thanks to Angela Alston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!